It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the House of Representatives wants to be able to sue the president for overstepping the bounds of his position. We're going to hear the latest from the nation's capital.
First, a new survey out this week has some good news for Wisconsin job seekers. The state's hiring outlook for the next few months is looking good.
The report also says that Wisconsin is outpacing many neighboring states in expected job creation. In terms of cities, Madison and Milwaukee are near the top of the national list of metropolitan areas expected to add workers this spring.
Joining us now to talk about the state's hiring outlook is Mike Ivey, reporter at the Capital Times, where he covers business and politics. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
Well, according to the Manpower Employment Outlook Survey, Wisconsin employers are expected to be hiring at a robust pace, as you write. How significant is this news for Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that it's a survey done by Manpower. It's the temp services agency based in Milwaukee, but they do a statistically significant survey of a bunch of different companies around the country. They do this for all the different states and the 100 largest metro areas, and they ask you, are you planning to add staff, keep your staff the same, or lay people off? And they come up with a number. Hopefully it's positive, meaning that you're adding jobs. So what they really came up with for Wisconsin is about 21% of the firms they talked to are planning to add jobs over the next quarter, the next three-month period starting in April. So, I mean, you can take it for what it says. I think what's significant is that Wisconsin has been lagging so many other states in job growth over the last several years that this may, you know, make an indication that things might be picking up here a little bit. I think it's important, too, to look at Milwaukee because that seems like such a key to the Wisconsin economy. Your largest metro area needs to be, you know, hitting on all cylinders to make the rest of the state go.
Well, let's pick up on how we're looking compared to our neighbors. What do we look like against other Midwestern states?
Well, they have this number that they throw on it, and we're tied with Iowa. It's called their net employment outlook, and it basically says what percent of companies are going to add jobs versus how many you're planning to lay off. They come up with a number. So Wisconsin's number is 21, same as Iowa. Michigan's 19, Minnesota 18, Illinois at 11. And if you actually look at the Chicago metro area, they're actually flat. No one's, when you take into account the people adding jobs versus losing them, no companies are, you know, their net number's flat. North Dakota, with its energy boom, has the highest NEO outlook, 25%. Alaska, Utah's in there. Kansas lowest at 7, and Hawaii. So, I mean, I like to look at all these numbers. But, again, it's a survey. It's an outlook. I think the good news here is that Milwaukee and the state seem to be picking up a little bit.
Now, this number is factored in there, but apparently 5% saying they are going to be dropping jobs in Wisconsin.
Well, I mean, companies add and drop jobs all the time. I was just reading in the paper about Marinette Marine adding some jobs with a shipbuilding that's going on. There was another company that was going to lay off 150 people. I mean, jobs come and go. It's not a static thing.
So do we know why Wisconsin seems to be doing so well in this report? Why the jump?
Well, some have said that we have been lagging for so long. There's been a lot of uncertainty about the economy here, and the companies have been waiting to do anything. And so maybe now they're feeling a little bit better about things. I think the construction boom is a big factor. Look at all the apartments that are going up, both in Madison and in Milwaukee, is seeing a pretty good construction jump. And that's actually what Manpower was saying was driving most of it, was the strong construction market here.
So you mentioning that. Any other industries that we expect to be hiring as part of this?
Like manufacturing they were talking about, which is always good. But again, that's such a large segment of the Wisconsin economy. Anyway, you'd expect those sectors to be adding. I think the only role, there's still some continuing weakness in retail and sales, which partly may be a reflection of people not feeling like they have a lot of money and they're going to go out and spend. I think one thing to factor into this, too, is the stock market has really recovered, and people may feel wealthier. You know, when you get your 401k statement, oh, the market's up, I feel like I have more money. So maybe you're out spending more money, and for that reason, people are buying stuff, and that all adds to the economy as well.
Now, you mentioned jobs come and jobs go, and that's just part of the flux that happens here. Mm-hmm. But which industries are not looking so hot?
Well, I think some of our durable goods manufacturers, as they call it, this would be heavy equipment, things that have been weak for a while, mining equipment, and these have been strong parts of the Wisconsin economy for a long time. I think it's important to know that some of those real heavy machinery areas have been hurting here for a long time. I mean, in some ways, Wisconsin never really recovered from that 1980s recession that really devastated manufacturing. And we continue to lose jobs to third world countries where costs are lower. So it's not a quick snapshot. The challenge for Wisconsin has always been how do we sort of retool ourselves, play off the strengths that we've got, but also embrace sort of this new economy that people talk a lot about based on computer technology. I think Epic Systems in Verona is a great example of a company that has had a tremendous impact on the Madison economy. There are 6,000 employees there, and it has fueled this tremendous apartment building boom in downtown Madison. Next time your listeners have maybe come through Madison, they might be stunned by the number of 12-story apartment buildings that have gone up, driven in large part by the number of people working at Epic Systems who seem to want to live downtown in a vibrant, exciting place, even though they need to commute 10 miles outside town to go to Verona. You have the reverse commute sort of going on. I think you're seeing some of that in Milwaukee as well. It's Milwaukee's downtown has been, I think, a little more vibrant than it's been in the past, and people like to live where fun things are going on.
Hey, you mentioned that Milwaukee is sort of the big story here, that they've taken the biggest turnaround, according to the survey. How important is this news to Milwaukee?
Well, I mean, I think anyone who follows the Wisconsin economic scene has said, you need to have your biggest metro area functioning at a high level. Milwaukee has struggled. There have been a lot of companies that have left. It's had trouble, retooling itself. I think it's important to note here that when they do talk about Milwaukee, they're talking about the Milwaukee metro area, which includes Waukesha County and West Allis. So when they put these numbers together, it's the metropolitan statistical area. So same with Madison. That would include all of Dean County. It's not just city-specific. But, the number of crunchers, they do the best they can with the numbers that they have.
So to take the political view with this news, in 2010, Governor Walker pledged to add 250,000 jobs to the state during his term. Democrats like to point out that he's running far short on that count.
Right.
Is this news going to be enough to compensate?
It's the great irony here is that you do end up with Walker detractors not liking to see jobs added or the economy picking up. It's some of the comments that you see posted on the different stories point that out, and I think the Republicans have even played that up. Why do you want to see Wisconsin doing poorly? At the same time, I think anybody who lives here has got to be rooting for the economy to improve, simply because I think we all benefit from that. Now, take a look at, I don't know if people saw the Rasmussen poll that came out today, showed that Mary Burke and Governor Walker running pretty neck and neck, so I'm not sure if maybe the jobs story won't be as big an issue as we had thought with all the other stuff that's gone on around the campaign so far. But it's certainly something people look at. What's the old line? People always vote with their pocketbooks. So,
all right. Well, Mike, we'll leave it there. I want to thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, always a pleasure, guys. Thanks.
We've been talking to Mike Ivey, a reporter at the Capital Times, where he covers business and politics. He joined us to talk about the positive hiring outlook here in Wisconsin. Time now for a visit to Washington for our weekly look at the inner workings of Congress.
Here's what's going on. Yesterday, accusations of CIA spying on Congress came to a head when Senator Dianne Feinstein said the agency had tampered with files in an investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Also, earlier this week, Republican David Jolly won a congressional seat in a special election in Florida. We'll find out if that's a good sign of things to come in midterm elections this fall.
But before we get to that, the House is looking for permission to sue the president. Paul Singer is with us now. He's Congress and Politics Editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Great. Thanks for having me back on, Rob.
Well, you tipped us off to this. The House wants to sue President Obama for overstepping the bounds of his role as president. What's the story leading up to that?
Well, as you are probably aware, President Obama, with the State of the Union address, was saying, heck, we can't wait for Congress to do stuff. We're going to do stuff on our own. We're going to do things through more executive orders and more unilateral executive action. The Republicans in Congress obviously are offended by that idea. They also, part of this is an outgrowth of the immigration fight. As you no doubt remember, President Obama made a big splash a year or two ago when he announced that they would stop deporting young people who were brought to this country illegally and remain undocumented immigrants here. Basically what the Republicans are saying is you can't choose which laws to enforce and which laws not to enforce. The administration is required to enforce the laws that Congress passes. And so the bill that's currently on the floor, and I believe they're voting even as we speak, would allow Congress to sue the administration if they fail to enforce the laws as passed. There's a second version of this bill that would require the administration to file a report with Congress every time they make a decision not to enforce a law. Some of the examples have been, what about a mandatory minimum sentencing, for example, or other things where the Justice Department is trying to apply some discretion. They would have to report that to Congress and give Congress essentially an opportunity to overrule.
Have we heard from the White House with a response to this?
Yes. The response from the White House was, forget about it. They issued two separate veto threats. Saying that the president would veto these bills if they were passed by the Senate. They will likely be passed by the House. They likely will never see the light of day in the Senate. And the administration's point here is that the law enforcement authorities always have to express some discretion to which things will be priorities, which things will not be priorities. I mean, in theory, it's illegal every time I go more than 55 miles an hour, but that may not be the highest priority use of law enforcement resources. Similarly, by the way, in some places, they were no longer enforcing marijuana laws, right, even though they're still on the books. So that kind of stuff, the administration says we're supposed to have the flexibility to do that kind of stuff, and this is an unreasonable attempt to tie the hands of the law enforcement community.
Well, if this isn't going to pass the Senate and would be vetoed if it did, is this one of those symbolic pieces of legislation you talk about sometimes?
Yeah, it's to some degree it's campaign bait. One of the things that the Republicans have repeated throughout the year and will continue throughout the campaign season is that the Democrats and President Obama want government overreach, want big government, a sort of imperial power here where Obama wants to act alone. That's going to be a theme you're going to hear the rest of the summer. We can talk about it up until Election Day. And I think that these votes are sort of the start of that theme for Congress this year.
Well, now here's a big story and kind of a weird one. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California yesterday very publicly accused the CIA of, in effect, spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee, tampering with some files. What exactly is she accusing them of?
This is really interesting. The Senate Intelligence Committee has been trying to put together a report on waterboarding and torture under the Bush administration. And they've been working, supposedly, fairly closely with the CIA on this report. And my understanding of what happened here is some information leaked or was released from that report. The CIA went to look at how it got released and reported to the Justice Department that they were concerned that there had been a leak by the staff. Feinstein's comments on the floor yesterday were remarkable. What she claims is that they basically broke into the committee's computers and were spying on the committee to figure out who had leaked this information and said it was a violation of the Constitution. The CIA immediately said, no, we didn't, and this was not a violation, and we were dealing with documents that we've been sharing all along and stuff. It's really interesting because it's the first time you've seen in public this kind of accusation back and forth between the chairman of the Intelligence Committee and the Central Intelligence Agency. It is obviously a very sensitive relationship at this point, and it just boiled over.
And hearing both of them, they both sound very sure of their side of the story. This isn't just some minor misunderstanding. They have very different views on what happened here.
They do, and that's not all that surprising, because, you know, as you know, the Senate is extraordinarily, Congress is extraordinarily protective of its own prerogatives, very concerned particularly about spying and eavesdropping by the administration. You know, this has been a whole thing with the NSA. You know, our Senate records or congressional records protected from the NSA. There were some reporters whose phone records were being captured, again, within the halls of Congress. It's a very delicate situation because this is there is a very, very clear rule that, you know, the administration cannot be doing law enforcement in the Capitol buildings.
Well, and beyond that, though, the CIA in particular isn't supposed to be doing domestic spying, period, on Congress or anybody, right?
That's right. And this is the kind of stuff that will drive Congress insane. They're very protective of these kind of things. And it's one thing, you know, if we catch the CIA doing domestic spying, they'd probably yell. You catch them doing domestic spying on members of Congress, Congress goes nuts.
And this all goes back to 9/11, right? The thing they're investigating is the coercive interrogation, waterboarding, and things like that.
That's right. Apparently there is a report. It's like a 6,000-page report that's been kicking around now for quite some time about what happened. And, you know, Feinstein said yesterday that this waterboarding was a policy, and the report says this waterboarding was a policy we never should have implemented. So again, I suspect that part of the issue here is this report is going to be very critical of the CIA. The CIA has asked for some changes to be made. There is obviously some disagreements about exactly what should be in this report. It's a very touchy situation at the moment.
Before we move on, who is the referee in this touchy situation between a prominent Senate Intelligence Committee member, chair, and the CIA?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. The Justice Department is obviously involved here because some of the question is whether or not the committee actually did something wrong or someone on the committee did something wrong. I presume they would have some ability to referee this. You know, ultimately, I suspect this becomes a White House issue where they can sit the parties down and say, we have to play nicely together.
Well, another story in Congress this week, a midterm or a little election in Florida there leading up to the midterm elections. A Republican, David Jolly, won a seat in a special election in Florida. A lot of people watching this one as an indicator, looking for tea leaves in what's going to happen this fall. Is this a valid indicator, do you think?
Well, you're right to say tea leaves. You know, tea leaves are not always wrong, right? It's certainly interesting. The outcome is certainly interesting. This was a district that had voted for President Obama. It was a district that had a Republican member of Congress for a long, long time, for like 40 years. He passed away, and this was the election to replace him. And one of the key themes of this election was Obamacare. The Democrat was saying we can save Obamacare and fix it and address the law's flaws. And the Republican was saying, no, we have to repeal it. It's a disaster. The reason people were looking at this race is they thought, well, if that message of Obamacare repeal is a really strong motivator, that indicates that Democrats are going to have trouble in the fall. In the end, the Republican did win this race, and today the Democrats on their conference call with their pollster were saying, yes, we believe the Affordable Care Act was a real motivating factor for people voting for the Republican candidate. Now, will it still be a motivating factor in November? We don't know. Will it still be a motivating factor all over the country? We don't know. But if nothing else, it appears that the Affordable Care Act really did have an impact in this election, and it was an impact that was not good for the Democrats.
And Republicans are hoping for another 2010 when they swept Wisconsin big time and the rest of the country, too. Democrats are probably living in fear of another 2010.
Well, that's right. And you know, the thing is, for Democrats, it's the Senate. It's all about the Senate now. They're not likely to retake the House by any stretch of the imagination. There are a half dozen Senate seats that are in play. You know, it is a very close field. It looks like the Republicans have a chance. If Obamacare is going to be toxic, then Republicans have a really good chance.
Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. That was Paul Singer. He's politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday around this time to share his insights on what's going on in Congress. More and more families find themselves in the position of providing care for elderly and other relatives, especially as the baby boomer generation gets older.
Our next guest says those families are being stretched too thin and that we're headed toward a caregiving cliff unless those families get some help.
John Schall joins us now. He's the CEO of the Caregiver Action Network. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, as we just mentioned, you have said that we're headed toward a caregiving cliff. What do you mean by that?
Well, we're headed for a caregiving cliff because right now, if you look at it, 90 million Americans are already caring for their loved ones who are either elderly or have some chronic condition. And the demographics are really not in our favor. That situation is just going to get worse. The American population is aging, which is terrific. People are living longer because of medical advances. But that's putting a heavier burden on family members to take care of their loved ones. And this is going to be very, very difficult in the years ahead.
90 million, you said, and that number you think is going to just keep going up?
Yes, we've seen a tremendous increase in just the last 2 or 3 years. 90 million Americans, so 4 out of 10 adults in this country, say that they're caring for either an elderly loved one or a child with special needs or someone who just needs their care at home. And that's 39% of the population. That's up from just 30% in just 2010. So we see there's just been a rapid increase in recent years, and that's just going to increase even more rapidly in the years ahead.
What kind of, and I know there are, this story is probably a little different for everyone, but what kind of strain does that put on families?
Well, it puts a tremendous strain on families in terms of their own health, not just the patient's health, and also on the pocketbook. There's no question about it. If you've been in this situation and you're caring for an elderly parent with Alzheimer's, or you have a child with autism, or let's say your husband had a heart attack or your wife had a stroke, you realize that that stress that you go through as the family caregiver can take a huge toll on your own health. In fact, we have seen adverse health outcomes on the family caregiver who's caring for their loved one. Not only that, but, you know, financially, this is terribly expensive stuff. On average, family members are shelling out over $5,000 a year in out-of-pocket costs to care for their loved ones for things that just aren't covered by insurance or Medicare. For instance, if you need the products to take care of your mother's incontinence, depends, or those incontinence products are not covered by Medicare. So there's a lot of out-of-pocket costs.
So that kind of expense, even without talking about institutional setting or professional in-home care.
That's absolutely right. Institutional care, can be quite expensive, on average $75,000, $85,000 a year. So this is situations where you're keeping your loved ones at home, which is terrific. It's great for them. It's actually great for the country in terms of health care costs. But it does put a burden on the family to do that care.
Are a lot of people in this situation because they can't afford institutional care or getting some kind of paid in-home help?
Well, it's a mixture of things. Some of it is people can't afford to get some in-home care, but really a lot of it is a much more positive story than that, that people are living longer, that elderly Americans actually want to stay in their homes longer, and we want them to. Frankly, it's cheaper for the country, but it's also better for their own health. Studies have shown the longer you can stay in your own home in a comfortable environment and being taken care of by your family, you're probably going to do much better. So there are positive reasons for it happening as well. But in the end, someone has to be doing that help, and that's usually a family member. And that brings with it an awful lot of stress on the system. It's always tough maybe to find flexibility in your own job so that you can have the time to take care of your loved one at home. And you're going to be much more susceptible to depression, feelings of guilt and anger for this role that you've been thrust into. It takes its toll.
It's a weird paradox almost. I think probably everyone is either in this situation or knows someone who's in the situation providing at least some kind of care. And yet when you talk about 90 million people and the cost, it's like this invisible part of our economy. Do we put enough value on the work that family caregivers are doing?
Oh, gosh, we certainly do not put enough value on it. And you put your finger right on it. It's this kind of great paradox that, almost all of us are in this situation or know someone who is. And yet policymakers really don't pay that much attention to it. We did one study to show what the economic value of this care being provided by family members is. And it's about $450 billion a year. Think about it. That's more than this country's Medicaid funding combined. If you put every state's Medicaid, it's not as much as that. That's $450 billion is twice as much as all in-home paid care or nursing home services. It's almost as much as Medicare itself. It's a huge investment that family members are making in the healthcare system. I'll tell you, if all family caregivers went on strike tomorrow, we never would because we wouldn't do that to our loved ones, but there's no way that the nation could afford to fill in that gap. That's how big and important a role that family caregivers are playing.
Well, sort of going on strike, are family caregivers talking about their situations enough, or do we feel like we don't want to talk about this tough situation, or, hey, it's our duty as a family member to do these things, so I should shut up and just do it?
Well, there is a lot of that, and that's a shame, because actually I think we'd be much stronger if people did identify themselves as family caregivers and make it clear what we all do. It is a huge undertaking. It's a great sacrifice. Of course we do it out of love, and of course we're going to do it. But policymakers need to be aware of it and pay attention to it, because it's an awfully important role, not only because we're providing care, but we're providing some very important care. By and large, it's the family caregiver who's managing the medications, for instance. Our survey shows 70% of the time it's the family member who's managing the meds, not the patient themselves. And they're also performing, you know, tasks that we usually associate with just nurses or doctors. You know, family caregivers at home are providing wound care. They're operating fairly sophisticated medical equipment in the home. These are very important tasks.
Are we getting out of our depth in some cases, either medical care that's above our pay grade, out of our training, or sheer physical tasks, helping lift someone up out of a couch that maybe we're not up for?
Well, I do fear we are getting a little bit out of our expertise, and that's one of the reasons that my organization, the Caregiver Action Network in Washington, D.C., provides free of charge to family caregivers across the country some training in those matters. I mean, none of us is born knowing how to do this. There are things you need to know about managing medications. There are helpful hints about lifting your loved one and transferring them from the bed to a chair without hurting your own self or your own back. And we do want to make those kind of tips and in educational materials available. So, yes, I think there's a huge need for more training of family caregivers who, frankly, are called upon to do these things anyway. And we better just train them so that we can avoid, harm to the patient and also harm to the caregiver themselves. And that's what we're trying to do free of charge. But it would be nice if the policymakers recognize that, too.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up. You mentioned policymakers a minute ago. What kind of policies can they make that would help these 90 million and growing number of people providing family care?
Well, it's interesting. The federal government did one very interesting thing a few years ago, about 3 years back. They actually provided, for the first time ever that I saw, in the veterans world, a stipend for the family caregiver who's caring for the wounded warrior. There are about 1 million family members out there who are caring for a loved one who came back from the war in Iraq or Afghanistan with injuries, frankly, that a soldier would not have survived in a previous war. So they're in a very different family caregiving situation than anything we've ever seen. And Congress created a veterans program where that family caregiver gets some training and gets a small stipend. It's not enough, but that's a huge step in the right direction. I would love to see more of that beyond just the veterans world, but for family caregivers generally, because it can make a big difference.
I read somewhere that you're mulling the idea of something you'd call a caregiver corps. What is that?
Well, a caregiver corps, kind of think of the Peace Corps or the Teach of America model, but really for the caregiving world. I come back to this notion of the demographics, kind of where we started this conversation. As the baby boomers age, it's going to be pretty tough a few years down the line to find enough people to care for those who actually need some care. You know, right now you got maybe 7 potential caregivers for every person over the age of 80. But when you look at 2050, when I'll be over the age of 80, you know, that's less than half of that. Instead of being a 7-to-1 ratio, there'll be a 3-to-1 ratio. So somehow we're going to have to find more people who are able to care for their loved ones or just others. And so I think of a caregiver corps you know, where we could recruit, let's say, college graduates, give them some loan forgiveness for their college loans, or, you know, people who are retiring but still active and still want to help, or family members who have been caregivers but are no longer caregivers who still would like to, you know, help others, and put them in a caregiver corps, give them some training, and, you know, make them available in the community for all these people who are going to need care.
We're talking to John Shaw with the Caregiver Action Network. He says we're approaching a caregiving cliff with families stretched thin trying to provide care for older relatives or relatives with disabilities.
We're continuing our conversation now about family care providers with John Shaw of the Caregiver Action Network. He says we're headed for what he calls a caregiving cliff.
And are you in this situation? Are you caring for maybe an older relative, a child with autism, anywhere in between? What is your life like? What kind of help could you use? What kind of reassurance could you use from other people? Is your workplace friendly to your needs? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself part of the sandwich generation? Maybe you're raising your kids and taking care of your parents. Again, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. John, are workplaces keeping up with these 90 million people who are providing care? Are they open to providing flexibility for people in this situation?
Oh, I wish I could say that they were keeping up, but no, I can't go that far. But I can at least optimistically say they are finally getting the message. I think if you looked at the workplace a few years back, there really wasn't much recognition of the need to pay attention to family caregiver needs, and there wasn't all that much flexibility. But in the last 2, 3, 4 years, there has been a movement among some companies to really recognize that need. And there are actually a couple of dozen of the largest companies in America who have come together in a coalition because they realize that they do need to respect a caregiver's time and provide that flexibility. Now, they're not just doing it out of the goodness of their heart. You know, American businesses are smart, and I think they finally figured out that you do want to give flexibility to those employees of yours who are caregivers, give them flex time or whatever is needed. Because if you lose those employees to recruit somebody else, to train them, and to start all over again with a new employee, it's actually more expensive than giving flexibility to that caregiver employee. So I think they're finally beginning to get it. Again, I don't want to overstate the case. We're certainly not where we need to be in the workforce. But finally, the message is beginning to get through a little bit.
You mentioned some help you provide, training for people dealing with some of the basics of caring for a relative. Are there community resources out there? Are there enough community resources out there to support groups, training, things like that in local communities?
Well, there certainly are some. There probably are not enough. Every community has a local area agency on aging. It may have whatever name, but basically a local area agency on aging that does some of this kind of help. But again, the problem with all those community services is they tend to be focused pretty much on the patient or the client as opposed to the family caregiver. And that's why we saw a need 20 years ago when we started this organization to provide some resources that really were focused on the family caregiver themselves, you know, how they can find respite, how family caregivers need to be on the watch for depression, because they're much more susceptible to depression than non-caregivers. That they have a place to vent and talk to other caregivers because they're going to feel, you know, emotions of anger and guilt that they're not going to want to express to their loved one, but are all part of the natural process of being, you know, in this role. So that's really the difficulty, and I think that was the gap we saw and are trying to fill as much as we can.
Let's bring our callers in here. We've got Barbara on the line in Little Suamico. Barbara, hi.
Hello. I feel like I've been a caregiver in one form or fashion all of my life. I'm in my mid-50s now, between being a widowed mother and caregiving for my father and my grandparents and now my disabled husband. And it's taken a toll in my personal life in that the career I thought I was going to have, at first I put on hold, and then I just watched it evaporate. And I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that I take care of other people. That's who I am. But I'm now looking at my own retirement years, and while I do have enough quarters paid in for Social Security, Medicare is going to be an issue for me because I just don't have the work history. And, of course, my Social Security isn't going to amount to much either. So I'm feeling, and I'm feeling a little underappreciated by society. That's the word.
Barbara, thank you so much for calling in, and we appreciate the work you've done for your family. John, she brought up a lot there. I don't even know where to start, really. First of all, people in this situation may be putting their own retirement planning, their financial planning for their own old age on hold while they're caring for others.
Yes, it's actually a very big issue, and Barbara put her finger right on it. Interestingly enough, about half of those 90 million caregivers across the country have been doing it for more than 5 years. It usually ends up being, as is Barbara's situation, you know, kind of a long-time commitment. It ends up really becoming your life. There can be a huge problem because in a lot of cases, the family caregiver has either had to go on part-time or leave the workforce entirely to devote themselves to those family caregiving responsibilities. I've tried to push with the policymakers, you know, if you can't afford to give stipends to caregivers, and I understand the overall budget environment, so maybe that's not too realistic, but if you look at the Social Security system, if a caregiver had to leave the workforce to do full-time caregiving, in my view, you should be able to still be building up Social Security credits during that time that you're doing full-time caregiving. Now, that's a much easier change to make for policymakers and doesn't have to involve, you know, direct expenditure of federal funds. So that's the idea I've been pushing. You know, let's change Social Security. So if you're actually doing full-time caregiving of your loved ones and you had to leave the workforce to do that, you should still be building up those Social Security credits for your own retirement's sake when you get to be 65. Because frankly, the answer is, you know, if all we've done is impoverish those caregivers when they get into retirement, that's going to come back onto the public system, too. So we're not doing ourselves any favor there. So let's do some changes on the Social Security side for that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Barbara, and good luck to you. We'll go now to Bess in Madison. Bess, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. This topic is near and dear to my heart. I am a nurse in Madison, and I'm glad. I didn't get to tune in to hearing everything that this gentleman had said, but I, from what I've heard, is absolutely the truth. My sister ended up taking care of my mother for more than 10 years at home. There are some comments I want to make about that, and in regards to my sister couldn't do it after a while, and we ended up having to hire somebody to come into the home. And, you know, I think that as a population, what he is saying is the baby boomers are growing older, and there is not going to be enough people out there to take care of people the older that they get. We need to look and see how much money that our government is spending to keep people in nursing homes. Because if we could look at an alternative as saying maybe there could be more group homes out there that would support people so they didn't need the skilled nursing facilities, it may be cheaper in the long run. I really feel that we are failing our seniors, and as I'm growing older, it makes me concerned. Who's going to be there to take care of us?
Bess, thanks a lot for the call. Failing our seniors, she says, John.
Well, she's got a point. There's no question. Home care is much less expensive than a skilled nursing facility or a nursing home. From a public policy standpoint, it would make perfect sense to make a larger investment to in-home care. Now, I wish I could say that rational reason carries the day with the policymakers in Washington, but that's not really the case. In fact, sometimes they still even bring up the idea of, you know, let's have a copayment in Medicare for those home care services again, which is just crazy. It's exactly the wrong way to go. If anything, we want to be doing more home care and less institutional care. So Beth's exactly right. I will also say, since she's a nurse, you know, thank God for the nurses. You know, you go into the healthcare professional's office, the nurses really understand it from the family caregiver role. They really get it. The doctors not necessarily always do, but the nurses really do, and I wish they would talk more to the doctors and make sure that the doctors are paying attention to the family caregiver and maybe even include the family caregiver on the patient's medical record so they know who to ask for questions, because sometimes the family caregiver will give you a much better answer about what symptoms or side effects they're seeing in the patient than the patient themselves will report.
For caregivers out there listening right now, maybe they're frustrated at their wit's end, what would you like to say to them?
Take care of yourself first. I know it sounds crazy, it sounds impossible, and you might even feel guilty doing it. But the fact is, caregiving takes a tremendous toll on your own health. And you have to take care of your own self first, because if something happens to you and you're not strong enough to take care of your loved one, that's not a good outcome. You want to be strong enough to care for your loved one. So make sure you're getting to the doctor. Make sure you're getting checked for depression. Make sure you're doing whatever you need to do to eat right, get some exercise, and get a break now and again. And even though you might feel guilty about, you know, taking care of myself first before my loved one who's got the chronic condition, believe me, it's the only way that this can work in the long run.
All right, we'll leave it there. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That was John Schall. He is CEO of the Caregiver Action Network.
Coming up, we continue our series of interviews on Act 10, 3 years out. Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach will join the show in just a bit.
And yesterday, if you missed it, in our archives, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a Republican, he was co-chair of Joint Finance when Act 10 was introduced 3 years ago. He joined the show. We started things off Monday with two reporters who wrote a book on Act 10 and the protests that followed. Later in the week, we'll be getting perspectives from union leaders in the state and a school district administrator as well.